Well, our speaker tonight is from the notorious Freddy Bar Group. The other bar group, okay, one of those bars, anyway. John the Judge H. How's everybody? Good? The goal for this evening in this heat is to stay awake. And really glad to be here tonight. And my name is Rush L., and I'm a recovering conservative. I shaved about a year and a half ago. I used to have a great big beard, and every time I put on my suit and a red tie and go to the courthouse, I get mistaken for Rush Limbaugh, so I thought I'd say that. I was planning on talking about my progression of humility in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's not enough people here, so I thought I'd better not do that. My name's John Hendrickson, and I'm an alcoholic. And they've been propping me up talking around this part of the country and other states for a long time. And it's only because of what I do for a living. Because they get a lawyer and a judge sober and they start propping you up right away because it's kind of an oddity, you know, they been doing that. And I was about 2 years sober. And my sponsor, who some of you know, is a large, imposing Italian by the name of Don M. And he informed me one week that I was going to the state of Washington to speak at the Washington State Annual Convention of Recovery Units in the state. And I went up there, and it was the first time that anybody had ever taped anything I'd ever said at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the governor was there and some other muckety-muck dignitaries, and I just had a great time. And they sent me the tape in the mail. And I had never heard any pitch that I'd ever given, so I was on my way to the beach, and I put the tape in the console, and I'm listening to myself, and I'm enjoying what I'm hearing, and I got about halfway through the tape, and I noticed a couple of things. I didn't do any of that shit. I would just kind of making up stuff as I was going along, you know, having a good time. And so I thought I better talk to my sponsor about it, and I very sheepishly told him what I had done, and he reminded me very sternly of the one of the overriding principles of our program, and that is the principle of living rigorous honesty. You know, you hear that in chapter 5 in this part of the country, at least, at every meeting. Rigorous honesty. And for those of you who are new, anybody less than a year here tonight? All right. That's terrific. Those of you who don't know what honesty in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, it's simply this. Honesty in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is admitting that at one time in your life, you quite possibly engaged in masturbation. Rigorous honesty in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is admitting you still do, you know. That's, I always tell a story to begin one of these pitches because it embodies the best I could do with a drug of alcohol. This is as good as I could do it. And it's a simple little story about a little guy who lived in Lincoln City, and he was a little drunk. And he was hungover one morning, and he's walking down the beach, and he trips over a sand dune, and a lamp pops out. And he picks up the lamp, and he brushes it off, and sets it on the sand, and a genie magically appears to the little drunk. And the genie looks at the little drunk and says, I am not your typical genie. I don't grant three wishes. What I do is I grant one gift and one wish. And the gift is my choice, and I see by your appearance that you're a drinking man, And I want to know, what is your favorite type of alcohol? And a little drunk thought for a minute, and he said, you know, I'm particularly enamored with that heart-shaped bottle that comes in the velvet blue bag of Canadian Crown. I see you're drooling over here. Canadian Crown Royal. And she says, okay. And she waves her hand across the sand, and magically appears is a giant bottle of Canadian Crown Royal. And she informs the little drunk that this bottle has magic powers. It will never go empty. The little drunk looks at the bottle, and he picks it up and takes a big hit off of it and sets it back on the sand and watches as it gurgles right back up to the top, brim full. And he does it a couple of more times, and each time the liquid level rises back to the top of the bottle. And the genie says to the little drunk, okay, sir, now, your wish. You may have anything in the world you want. I will grant you. What is your wish? And little drunk thought for a minute, and he said, give me another one of those. That's as good as I can do it. That's as sane as I can get with alcohol. You know? I have been clean and sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous this time. Since April 7th of 1983, and I'm well into my 16th year of sobriety, and for that I am truly grateful. And but this is not the first time, as you will discover, that I have been to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those of you who don't know what I do for a living, I'm a lawyer and a judge in the state of Oregon, and I've been a judge in this part of the country for 19 years and a lawyer for more than a quarter of a century. And when I was growing up, I was the fair-haired boy in my community. Everybody liked me. My father was a city administrator of a small little town in Southern California called Huntington Beach. It was small then. And I had some talents, and I would perform at Rotary Clubs and around, and everybody thought that I was going to be wonderful. I was quite an athlete when I was young, and I had fulfilled a childhood dream, and I had become qualified and became a member of the 1960 United States Olympic team. And I was scheduled to go to Italy that year to compete. And after I had been to a training session, we got off the airplane in Los Angeles, California. And I'm 18 years of age, and there were some deputy sheriffs from Orange County, California there. And they arrested me. Me, an Olympic athlete, for Christ's sake. They arrested me. And I got arraigned the next morning in front of this large, imposing female judge in Orange County, California. And it seems as though there was a misunderstanding in the community. They claimed that I had developed a community habit that was not acceptable. What I would do, you see, is I would invite myself into your house without first being asked and borrow shit that didn't exactly belong to me. And so I got arraigned on 14 some odd counts of first-degree burglary. And I had some lawyer my parents had propped up, and I didn't really know much about all that stuff, but I was an official adult in the state of California. And this large, imposing judge said, young man, I have some information here that quite possibly you may have a problem with alcohol. And there's this new outfit in town that just might help you. And so before I'm going to sentence you, I'm going to send you to 5 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Goddamn judge sent me to 5 meetings of AA. This is 1960. When it wasn't popular to do that. And the meeting was in Huntington Beach, California, across from the pier in the Boar's Head Bar. And you had to go through the bar to get to the back room where the meeting was. And there was an old little rickety table, and there was probably 8 or 9 old guys in there. You know? They must have been shit, 30, 35 years of age, did they? And their life was over. What the hell do they know, for Christ's sake? You know? And I was a little drunk when I got there, and a lot drunker afterwards, and I went to those 5 meetings, and I don't remember much of anything about those meetings. But that was my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't get back to Alcoholics Anonymous until 1983. Now that's 23 years. I think they classify that as a world-class slip for 23 years. So I was back in front of that judge, and she said, well, I'm going to have a pre-sentence investigation done on you, and she sent me to a treatment center. Well, it really wasn't a treatment center. In California in 1960, they didn't have treatment centers. You know, they got treatment centers coming out your ass everywhere now. You know, they've got Washington is just full of them, and Oregon has got them all over the goddamn place. Happy Rock Glen Rattlebox on the Hill over here, and Spring, whatever that's going on down in Newburgh. They're everywhere. But in California in 1960, they called them California State Mental Institutions. So I spent 30 days in Norwalk Mental Institution doing the Thorazine Shuffle, and they would send these doctors around to talk to me. And this one psychiatrist came, and it was a Tuesday or Wednesday, and he wanted to talk to me and find out how I felt about my mother. You know, and my mother had turned me in. So I told this doctor what I felt about my mother on a Tuesday. Another doctor came around and talked to me on a Friday. He asked me the same dumb question. He wanted to know how I felt about my mother. So I told him what I felt about my mother on Friday. And these doctors got comparing notes and decided I wasn't telling them the truth. So I got kicked out of a goddamn mental institution. And I'm back in front of that judge, and she said, well, that didn't work. And she sentenced me to a term of months in the Northern California State Penitentiary. I'm 18 years of age, blonde hair, blue eyes, 173 pounds, real cute. And so I went, and I wasn't there very long, thank God, and some people came through the penitentiary in blue uniforms. And these guys were recruiters from the Air Force. They were looking for people with talent. And I promptly raised my hand, and they were looking for musicians. And I was forced to take piano lessons at gunpoint by my parents. So I knew how to play the piano, and they threw some music up in an old upright like this one over here, and I played the music, and this sergeant came over to me and he said, young man, he says, we want you to be a member of the United States Air Force. I said, you mean I get out of here? He said, yes. I said, thank you, sergeant. That's my kind of sergeant, that guy. So I got out of the penitentiary and was allowed to enlist in the United States Air Force. I spent 4 years in the Air Force, and guess what I did? I played the piano in the cocktail lounge here at the officers club for 4 years. Stayed pleasantly shit-faced for 4 years. And I got out of there, and I got married when I was in the Air Force, and this lovely 18-year-old lady from Massachusetts, and she was a Catholic, and I wasn't. And in order to get married, I had to convert to Catholicism. And I did that, and I learned of all the mysteries of the Catholic Church, and my lovely young bride taught me about sex in the Catholic religion. I mean, that is really frightening stuff. I mean, she taught me that in the Catholic religion, sex is filthy, it is nasty, and it is dirty. And you're supposed to reserve that for the one you really love, you see. That's the... But I got out of the military, and I was a good student at one time, I remembered, and I came back to Southern California and talked my way into some college down there, and I did pretty well. And everywhere I ever went, I had to find a job. And the job had to have two prerequisites. It had to have alcohol, and it had to have a cash register, because I knew how to do those things very well. So I spent 3 years as the resident manager of the Gourmet Liquor Mart in Claremont, California, while I was going to school. And how many people have been to a California-style liquor store? Those of you who haven't been, I mean, this place was bigger than this room. and it was filled with every type of alcohol from every country in the world. And you would stand at the front window as the sun was going down, and it would begin to shimmer and glow. And when the stars came out, it would glitter with the reflection from the sky. Ah. What a place that was. When I went to work there, right across from the cash register was the rum section. And my goal was to drink one of each for the entire room by the time I graduated. And I started in the rum section, and I didn't quite make it. I got over here to the left in the Greek section. Over here, that shit tastes pretty bad, but it gets the job done, you know. And I'm staggering around the campus one day and discovered that I was qualified to graduate, and I was a little older than most of the students, and one young professor came up and asked me if I ever thought about going to law school, and I said no. And so he talked me into applying to go to law school, and I did that, and threw up my money, and somehow got into a law school in the state of Oregon, in Salem Willamette University College of Law. When I got there in 1970, I found the job. I was the night manager of the bowling alley in the south side of Salem, and it had a bar and a cash register, so I was felt right at home. And 3 years later, I became a lawyer in the state of Oregon, and my very first job in Clackamas County was as a prosecutor prosecuting drunk drivers. And I was really good at it. They didn't understand that one drunk just can't lie to another one, you know. They just never figured that out. And I became, got out of there, and I went into private practice with another guy who drank just like I did. And while all this is going on, this lovely little 18-year-old Catholic girl that I had married, somehow had become, after about 11 years, really sick. I never quite figured out how that happened, but she didn't drink. And I had made her very, very ill, my alcoholism. And the marriage had broken down into ugliness on a daily basis, and I will describe for you what I call the nightly communications ritual. This, as I describe this, might be reminiscent of something in your past, or it might be something that's going on in your household right now. I would come home anywhere from 6 o'clock to midnight, usually a little boozed every night, and we would get the kids to bed. And she would always be in bed first. And I would come to bed, and I would sneak way over to the side of the bed so we wouldn't have any personal contact touching each other. And she would ask me the question. She would say, "Did you lock the front door?" And I would say, "Yeah, I locked the front door." And she would say, "I bet you didn't lock the goddamn front door." And I would say, "Okay, I'll check." And I'd slam out of the bed and go down the goddamn hallway to the front door, you know, and lock it. And get back and slam in bed. And she would say, "You always do that to me." And I would say, "Susie, for Christ's sake, I don't want to argue with you tonight." And she would say, "Don't you raise your voice to me." And the fight was on. I'd had it. I'd grab the goddamn sheet and the pillow, and I'm off down the hallway. I'm going to sleep in the study in the chair, you know. And she's right behind me. Yip, 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 chip, 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 all the way down the goddamn hall. We get to the door and try to push it closed. She'd try to push it open, yelling and screaming at each other. I'd either get it closed and sleep in the goddamn chair. If I couldn't get it closed, I'd run out the front door, get in the car, and go down to the local bar and bitch about it to the bartender. That was every night. Every night. Until the last night I was with that lovely lady. Same ritual. Same running down the hallway. Same screaming at each other. But I snapped. Picked that little girl up, and I threw her across the kitchen and hit her head against the wall. And she got up, and she came at me in a rage. And she put her hands on me. And I picked her up and pushed her away, and I walked out of that house, and I never went back. I was living in Salem then, and I got my old pickup truck, and I drove to Oregon City, where I worked. It's about 40 minutes. It was about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I went up to the man's house that I worked for. And I rang his doorbell, and he came, and he took one look at me, and he said, "John, what happened to you? Were you in an accident?" And And I looked down, and I was full of blood. My shirt was soaked, my pants were soaked, my sneakers were full of blood, and I was leaving bloody trails as I walked down the walkway. And what had happened when she came at me in a rage, she put her hands on my chest, and her fingernails went through my ribs and broke off and severed a vein in my chest, and I was bleeding to death, and I didn't even know it. They took me to the hospital, and the little doctor fixed me up. In a little alcove in the emergency room in Oregon City, the doctor looked at me and he said, "John," he says, "I know about you. If you don't do something about your drinking, this is going to happen again." And you know how we are, you know. I knew I was in trouble, but you can't admit it. I couldn't tell that man, "Yes, I know, sir." I said, "You think I drink too goddamn much? I'll quit." And I did. Next day, no trouble at all. Second day, no trouble at all. Now about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, neck muscles get a little tight. Had that general feeling of full of irritability and discontent. I read that in a book someplace. But I didn't have a drink that second day. I got up that third morning, and there was shit crawling all over me, and I couldn't get them off, and I knew I was in real trouble. So I went to the only remedy I knew. I went to psychiatrists. I went to 6 psychiatrists at the same time, one each in a different city. And you know what these guys wanted to know? They wanted to know how I felt about my mother, for Christ's sake. You know? 23 years later, you know, they're still asking the same dumb question. And I would lay some story on these guys, and they would. One guy thought that I was had this attention deficit disorder, and he thought he really needed to calm me down, so he'd give me 25 milligram prescriptions for Thorazine. And the next guy thought that in order to get to the real root of the problem that I was having, that I needed Valium, and so I had 3 or 4 prescriptions of 10 milligram Valiums. And some other guy had a different theory. He thought that the opposite was true, so he would give me prescription for Black Beauties or prescription methamphetamine, and I had jars of this stuff. And I set about a 3-year plan of better living through chemistry. And this is getting toward the end. And I will describe for you, and I am not one that is a real advocate of talking about drugs in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's probably very, very few pure alcoholics left in this world. But that is my drug of choice. But this is part of my story, and I will describe for you just before I finally got to you for this last time what I was like in a 24-hour period. By this time, I'm a judge in the state of Oregon, and this is what I look like. Weighed about 285 pounds. I had shoulder-length pageboy hair. I had a beard that completely covered my chest and 8-inch white mustaches on each side that I bleached with Clorox. I wore full-length fake white mink coats, black leather hats with braided leather off the back, and baby roses on the left side of my beard. That's the way I went to work. I would show up at the courthouse, and people just kind of went away, you know. They didn't know what to do with me. I didn't know what to do with me. In order for me to function every morning, I would come to after having a couple of hours of pass-out sleep at about 5:30 every morning. Absolutely, abjectly terrified. In order for me to function, I'd have to reach in the drawer and drag out a handful of whatever I could find, speed, and eat a handful of that, and lay down on the floor, because the heart would start and it would stop and it would flutter, and then the cramps would happen around the heart muscle and feel like you're eating hard-boiled eggs. And I'd get in the shower as hot as I could stand it, and I'd get out and manage to get dressed and stagger down to the courthouse and go to work. And I couldn't hold anything in my hands, and somewhere around 10 or 10:30 I'd have to eat an equal amount of either Valium or Thorazine in order to calm down to get through till noon. And to run out of that courthouse and get to the business of what I really wanted to do, and that's have a half a dozen double hooks or whatever I was drinking at the time at the local bar. And maybe I'd get back to work and maybe I wouldn't. And sometime around 4 in the afternoon, in order to stay awake, I would have to eat another handful of speed in order to just function so I could get out of that goddamn place and run down to the bar and get to the business. And the business is, I was desperately trying to find that 30 seconds where I felt okay. And I would pour that stuff down my guts, and I'd be crying inside and crying outside. And sometime between midnight and 3 o'clock, I would start the nightly ritual. Because I didn't know how to get out of what I was into. I was so full of terror and so full of pain that the only sane thought I could find was to kill myself. So I have an office in Gladstone, Oregon, on the Clackamas River, on the banks of the river, and they call it the High Rocks area. And I would go down to my office in the dead of winter, and I would go down to the rocks, and I'd stand there in the freezing cold and try to get the courage to step off into the water. But I couldn't do it, and the tears would run down my face. And I'd get in my car, and I'd drive the 205 freeway around the West Linn, the 10th Street exit, round and round until I found the 18-wheeler coming up the other side, to where I knew that if I turned the wheel just a little bit more to the left, I'd go down the embankment and hit that truck, and it would be over. And I couldn't get the courage to turn the wheel, and the tears would come down on my face, and I'd drive home. And I'd lock myself in the garage in the dark and pull out the crate and sit on it in the middle of the night and pull out the 9mm and load it and stick it in my mouth and pray that I'd have the courage to pull the trigger. And I can still hear the sound of the spring of the trigger pulling back, and I can still taste the gun oil in my mouth, and I couldn't do it. And I'd put the gun down, and I'd manage to fall down and pass out for a couple of hours and start it all over again one more day. And this time I was married to another lady that had found this chicken shit outfit called Al-Anon. And she'd been going to Al-Anon for a couple of years and learned how to handle a drunk that lives in her house. And they planned an intervention on me, and I tricked them. Part of the intervention team was a doctor who lived in Lake Oswego. Dr. Ken, he was the alcoholic doctor. Those of you who knew Ken, he died sober, no longer living. And I defended Dr. Ken on every one of his drunk drives, saved his medical license, got him into treatment in Atlanta, Georgia, where I didn't know what treatment was for. And I went to see Ken because he called me on the telephone and said that some insurance company needed a blood test and something that was some kind of bullshit. So I went over and saw Dr. Ken, and he took some blood from me, and about an hour later came back and he said, I want to give you the results of your blood test. Your liver enzymes are all over 400. Your liver is 2.5 times its normal size, and you will die in 6 months screaming from an exploded liver. He says, there's no hope for you. And he came around the table, and there was something different about Ken. Ken was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd been sober for about 4 years. And he put his arm around me, and he looked at me, and he said, John, there's a place I can have you go, or we can teach you what's wrong with you. And if you never want to take another drink for as long as you live, you won't have to. Will you go? That's pretty good leverage in a one-on-one intervention, right, from a doctor. Hey, kid, you're going to die in 6 months. Now, do you want to go over here? I said, yes, I'll go. So I spent 30 days in a not-so-fancy rattle box in downtown Portland, overlooking Burnside. And there were two things that I wasn't going to do in that hospital. I wasn't going to have anything to do with this chicken shit outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'd been there, you know, in 1960, and that didn't work. And John wasn't going to talk about God because he, she, or it did not exist. I was educated far beyond my intelligence. And I knew that the worst thing I could do, right, is to stand out in some goddamn open area someplace and say, here I am, take me, you know. I knew what his will for me was, and I didn't want any part of it. No part of it. And those of you who've been in treatment centers know what they're all about. I was there for 20 minutes. Discovered, much to my chagrin, that the entire damn place was run on the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John was going to have to talk about God whether he wanted to or not. And I wanted to run out of there. But I stayed. I stayed. In treatment centers, they have what is called the unitary concept of recovery. You know what that means? Those of you who have been in them, you know what that is. Everybody does everything together. You get up at the same time together. You make your beds together. You eat breakfast together, right? You take a crap together. Everything you got to do together. Right? Then you go down these funny little rooms and some counselor stands up there and you get a lecture, right? And every one of the lectures was about the disease concept of alcoholism and the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the very first day, this guy started talking about God. I'm out of my chair and in the hall. What has to happen? Nobody can go out in the hall by themselves. The whole group has to come out and talk you back in the goddamn room, right? Everybody's got to do it together. So they talk me back in the room. Next time somebody mentions God, I'm out in the hallway. You know, I did this for 4 days. They were sick of me. I have a sponsor in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name is Don, and he is my friend. He was the one who got me to that treatment center. He came to that treatment center every night, picked me up, put me in his car, and drove me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those of you who know Don know that he's a very gentle soul. He would pick me up and say, "Get in a goddamn car. Shut up." And he would talk to me on the way to the meeting, tell me what happened to him and how he got to Alcoholics Anonymous and what his life was now. Get to the meeting, he'd tell me where to sit. Shut up. At the end of the meeting, he would tell me to pick up the ashtrays, pick up the chairs, get back in the car, take me back to the hospital. He said, "I'll be here tomorrow night and pick you up." Every night. Well, on the fourth night, I got up a little courage and I said, "Don, these people want me to believe in God." He said, "Why?" He said, "Well, they start talking about this third step stuff." And he said, "Well, what is the third step?" And he hands me the book and I'm looking through it and I find the chapter 5 where it lists their 12 steps of the program. And I said, "See right here, it's step 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him." It's talking about God right there. He said, "No, it's not." I said, "Yes, it is." He said, "No, it's not. Read the step to me again." Okay. Made a decision. He said, "Stop right there. What does the step ask you to do?" Make a decision. He said, "Yeah." Step 3 has nothing to do with God. You don't have to believe in anything. All you have to do, John, he tells me, is to make a decision. Are you going to stay here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and get well, or are you going to go back out there and try it one more time? How you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, he said to me, is simple. It's by doing steps 4 through 12. He said, "If you do steps 4 through 12, John, you'll get the only guarantee that this chicken shit outfit promises us. And there's only one guarantee here," he said. "If you do 4 through 12, John, after making that decision to stay here, your spirit is guaranteed to be awakened." And I didn't understand what that meant. So I go back to that hospital, and on the fifth day, there's a man in that hospital that you all know, and he is my friend, and his name is Jeff W., and he is a biker from Goldendale, Washington. Probably didn't know that about Jeff, and Jeff had been in there 21 days longer than I was. He was a spiritual giant. And Jeff had heard a tape from a very famous speaker, his name is Bobby E., 1979 tape. And he was quite taken with this. And Jeff W. literally saved my life. Because he gave me the most spiritual third step prayer that I'd ever heard. It was the only way to get through to me. On the fifth day, I'd made the decision I was going to keep my ass in that chair and I was not going to go out in the goddamn hallway, but I just couldn't help myself. They started talking about God about noon, and I'm out in the hallway one more time. And Jeff comes out of the hallway, and he's down at the other end of the hall, and he looks at me and screamed at me with the top of his lung. He said, "John, if God's not up there, you're fucked." And for the first time in my life, I did not have an answer. No answer at all. And I went to Jeff and I said, "Okay, man, what do I do?" He said, "It's simple. You open your mouth and you ask for help whether you believe or not." I said, "Okay, man." So I go back to my room, third floor of the Medical Center Hospital, downtown Portland. Go into the bathroom, turn off the light, lock the door. Ain't going to be nobody seeing this old cool-looking judge praying, for Christ's sake. It just wasn't cool. Sat on the crapper, and I simply said this. I said, "Hey, man, if you're there, they tell me that you can take away all this pain. And if you would do that, I'd really appreciate it." And unlike Bill's room, the room didn't light up, and the wind didn't blow through, and nobody spoke to me from the void. But I turned the light on, and something had happened to me in that bathroom. The pain was gone. I was filled with a sense of well-being, that everything was going to be okay. All of the holes and the deep, dark crags and the lonely places and the coldness in my guts was gone. And I opened that door and I walked out of that bathroom, and I felt different. And you people look different. And I'm halfway down the hall, and I'm suddenly consumed with a brand new fear. I thought, "Oh my God, I got to get out of this damn hospital, go get a dark suit and a little string black tie, and carry track literature door to door." I didn't have to do that. I got out of that hospital, and my sponsor, Don, kept doing the same thing that he'd done for other people and would have been done for him. He drugged me in my ass to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night. And I made a mistake at 6 months sober. I said, "Don, how many of these meetings do I have to go to?" And he said, "Kid, we've looked at your case. And we've decided that you only have to go to meetings on the days that you drank." I said, "Oh, yeah, but that's every day." And for the better part of 15 and a half years, that's what I do. You know, that's what I do. Don sat me down, and I can remember that fourth night, and he explained to me what had been explained to him by his sponsor, Ray O'Kay, about what the founding fathers of our program meant by the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he explained it to me in about 3 minutes. He said, "The first three steps of our program, John, are the emergency steps. Just like an emergency room in a hospital. He says, those three steps will keep you sober long enough so you can make that decision. And that decision, as I described to you before, is, am I going to stay here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and get well, or am I going to go back out there and try it one more time where all the terror and all the pain is? Four and five are going to teach me about me. I'm going to discover what the disease of alcoholism did to my character. The character of a little blonde-haired little boy that at one time in his life really wanted to do the right things. I wanted to tell the truth. I wanted to do the right things. And I wanted to be a good person. But along the way of life and the disease of alcoholism, I couldn't tell the truth. I was not a nice person. And I didn't want to live. So if I do four and five, I'm going to discover who I am. I thought I was a nice guy who drank too much. I discovered that I was a lying, cheating asshole who lied and cheated his way through life, that I ruined and was dishonorable and dishonest to every person I ever came in contact with. But I was a liar and a cheater and a thief. That's who I was. And that's what I discovered in 4 and 5. 6 and 7 is a beginning, as the founding fathers wanted me to know. A beginning to know that I can't get well by myself. That I'm going to have help. Not to act on those character defects that I discovered in 4 and 5. If I'm going to learn how not to be a thief, and not to be a liar, and not to be a cheat, I have to have help. And all they want us to do in 6 and 7, Don told me, was to get ready. He said, "You ready?" I said, "What do you mean, am I ready?" He said, "Well, when you get up in the morning, don't you have to get ready to go to work?" "Yeah. I got to brush my teeth, and I have to take a shower, and get dressed, and I got to get ready. So when I'm ready, what do you do?" "Well, I'm ready, I get in my car and I drive. I go to work." I said, "Well, are you ready?" 6 months to know. Am I ready to get well? That's all it wants me to know. 7 is whether I believe or not. That God that I made contact with in that bathroom, please help me not to be a liar and a cheater and a thief every day. Please help me to do the right thing. I'm ready. Please help. 8 and 9 are going to get me even with the world so that I can hold my head up and never have to duck in another goddamn doorway again. You know, I was always ducking in doorways. Here comes George on the other side of the street. I'm in a doorway over here, you know. I either owed him money, you know, or I didn't know what the hell I told him yesterday. You know, here comes Sally Sue, you know, down the courthouse steps. Oh, Jesus, I got to go in the bathroom and lock myself in the stall, for Christ's sake, you know. I didn't know what I told Sally Sue or what I did to Sally Sue the night before. Gets me even with the world. And I made that list, and I gave it to my sponsor, and he gave it right back to me, and he said, "This is not the list." I said, "What do you mean this is not the list?" So the step says, "All people we had harmed." He said, "Where's your first ex-wife?" "She's not on the list." "But she ain't going on my list." I said, "Even dead people?" "All people we had harmed." "Even people that I'll never see ever in my life again?" "All people we had harmed." "Even people that didn't know I screwed them?" "All people we had harmed." So I completed the list, and he helped me in the 8th and the 9th step process do what I was supposed to do to get even with the world. When I got to you in Alcoholics Anonymous on April 7th of 1983, I was $651,000 in debt. And there was no way out. I was about to lose my license to practice law. The Judicial Fitness Commission was sniffing around the corners, you know, taking a look at this guy that wore the way I looked and sneaking out of the courthouse and getting drunk every day. The mortgage company wanted my house. My wife was on her way out the door. I was being sued by several banks. Judgments coming every which way, and I had no way to pay it back. And I made the list. And I went to my sponsor and I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "Well, you start here. This is what you do. Make the contact, make the appointment." I went and I sat down with the person. I said, "George, this is what I have done. This is what I'm responsible for, and here's my plan to pay you back." And I did that with all of them. With no hope, but did what I was told. At the end of 1 year clean and sober in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, on April 5th, my birthday, my belly button birthday of 1984, I was debt free. And I never asked anybody to forgive one penny of any debt that I owed. Miracles happened in my life that are unfathomable, and only because I asked for help in a bathroom in Portland, Oregon, with the light turned out. Now we've got the tape turned over. The second 2 or 3 hours of this talk are going to be a lot better, I think. But at the end of 1 year clean and sober, I was debt free. Absolutely debt free. I didn't stay debt free over the next 15 years, but that's life. You know, that's life on life's terms. I sat about on doing service work. I sat about doing everything I was told in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been the group secretary, the treasurer, GSR, assistant GSR, worked in committees at the state level, and have been a speaker around the western part of the United States for quite a while. And I love being secretary of my home group. How many have been secretary of the home groups? Ah, isn't that great? You get to do something. And you get up and you got this paper and you got a pencil and you're writing shit down, right? And the newcomers are really impressed, you know, that you're writing this shit down. And I was really bored, you know. So I'm a secretary for about 6-8 months in the home group in Canby, Oregon. And I started writing down every phrase of Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard at a meeting. And I had reams of paper with all of this stuff written on it. I was sitting in my office one day and decided I'm going to make one sentence out of all the phrases I'd ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd written down. So I typed these all out. I sent them into the grapevine about 10 years ago. And it's entitled The AA Phrases. Now, this is everything I know about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, one day at a time, I keep it simple. Well, I let go and I let God because without God, I don't have a prayer. Because I can and He can, and I think I'll let Him, and you'll love me until I can learn to love myself. For when I suit up and show up and share my experience, strength, and hope, and I don't drink, and I go to meetings, and I don't worry, because worry is an insult to God. And if you ain't the lead dog, the scenery never changes. And Alcoholics Anonymous lets me live and let live to not get too hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, because alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And if I pick up the phone before I pick up a drink, I'll stay happy, joyous, and free to see the light at the end of the tunnel, which I know today is the sunlight of the Spirit and not an oncoming train. Where I sought the relief from the compulsion to drink, and I need to think. But with me, it's with what, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, and I don't ever have to take another drink if I don't want to, and I had to keep it simple to know that if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk, so I then knew to just do the next dumb thing, so my life would be higher powered, because I was trying to learn that today is a tomorrow that I worried about yesterday, because I have to surrender my will and my life in order to know the proper exercise of my will, because the results of my life are none of my fucking business. For when I develop an attitude of gratitude, because nothing changes if nothing changes, and I remember that wherever I go, there I am. And if it's bad now, a drink will make it worse, for AA is really the easier, softer way, so one day at a time, I keep coming back. And that's all I know about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in one sentence. I had trouble in sobriety. It seems as how every time I would make a decision, I'd get all screwed up. You know, I'd look off in the distance and see something John liked. Hey, my head would say, that's neat, let's go get that. I'd make this decision, I'd go get that, I'd have it, and I'd ask, why am I dying here? Every time I made a decision, it seemed to be the wrong goddamn decision. I couldn't figure out why I was always getting my ass in trouble. Continually going to my sponsor and saying, God dang it, Don, I did it again. Why do I keep doing that? And one day Don got fed up with me, and he looked at me and he said, quit doing it. I said, oh. That had never occurred to me. You mean just don't do that? Because I was always the one who had to figure out why I did something before I could stop doing it. Does that sound familiar to anybody here? And how I began to see the secret here in Alcoholics Anonymous of what the term in our book, living happy, joyous, and free, really means. And I'm one of these guys that you can sit and explain to me in great detail what something means, and I won't get it. But you tell me a story in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll go, oh, yeah, I see what you mean. And this story literally changed my life in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a simple little story, and you may have heard it before, but it's my very dear story for me. It changed my life. A knowing of what I am not to do on a daily basis by interpreting what happens in my own life. Simple little story about an old man who lived in a small little country in Europe many, many years ago. And this old man owned this magnificent white horse. And this horse was desired by kings. And the royalty would come to the old man and offer him vast sums of money to sell this horse. And the townspeople would come out and say, "Old man, sell the horse. Get the money and move into town and live like a king." The old man would look at the townspeople and say, "I can't sell my horse. The horse is my friend." And the townspeople would shake their head and say, "You're stupid, old man. You should sell that horse." And about 10 days later, this horse ran away off into the mountains. And the townspeople came out and said, "See, old man, it was a bad thing. You should have sold that horse. Because now he is gone, he can be no use to you, and you can't move into town and live like a king." And the old man would look kindly at the townspeople and say, "I don't know that it's a bad thing. All I know is I had a horse, and the horse was my friend. And now he is gone, but I don't know that it's a bad thing." And about 10 days later, the horse came down from the mountains back to the old man's farm, and he brought 6 other horses with him. And the townspeople came out and said, "Old man, how wise you are. It wasn't a bad thing, it was a good thing. Because now you have these 6 other horses, and you can break them and sell them and still move into town and live like a king." And the old man would look kindly one more time at the townspeople and say, "I don't know that it's a good thing. All I know is that my horse is my friend. And he went away, and now he has brought these other horses back with him, but I don't know that it's a good thing." And he set his 16, 17-year-old son to the task and the job of breaking these horses in the corral. And while the son was breaking one of the horse threw him off and broke both of his legs. And the townspeople came out and said, "How wise you are, old man. It wasn't a good thing, it was a bad thing. Because now your son has 2 broken legs and he can be of no use to you." And the old man would look at them one more time and say, "I don't know that it's a bad thing. All I know is the horse was my friend. He was gone and came back with the horses, and now my son has 2 broken legs, but I don't know that it's a bad thing." And about this time, this small little impoverished country went to war against this large, imposing, powerful country. And the government came through and conscripted all the able-bodied young men to fight in this losing war. And all the parents knew that their sons were going to die. But you see, the old man's son didn't have to go because he had 2 broken legs. And there is no end to this story. To realize that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have got to get rid of all of my old ideas, even my ideas of right and wrong, and good and bad. See, if I don't get rid of those ideas, I'm operating on John's power. And it's only the power of God that exists in our program of Alcoholics Anonymous that can make the decisions for what happens in my life. So I operate on a daily basis that whatever happens in my life, I try to interpret it this way. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I just know that that has happened. And God's will for me is whatever the next thing that's in front of me that I'm supposed to do. I'm not supposed to shove that aside and go do this. I'm supposed to do whatever put in front of me. That story literally changed my life in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It brought with it a sense that God was in charge, that my life results are none of my business, that truly lets me keep my hand out in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to let the next person help that next person through the door, and literally and figuratively have taught me the love of God in our program. And I'm going to wind this up. It's getting kind of hot in here. I heard a wonderful... How many Al-Anons we got in here? We got any Al-Anons in here? Hey, have I got a story for you. Another one over here. This is the greatest Al-Anon story I've ever heard. Farmer and his wife live outside Hillsboro, Oregon. farmer is a terrible drunk, and his wife doesn't know what to do with her husband. Finally calls the family doctor. Takes the old man in to see the family doctor. Doctor does all of the tests, blood tests, the physical tests, everything. Takes all day long, and the wife waits patiently in the waiting room. Gets all through the tests, and the doctor calls the wife in and leaves the husband out in the waiting room. And she says to the doctor, "What is wrong with my husband?" "Well," the doctor says, "he's suffering from great stress in his life." She said, "Well, what can I do to help him?" She said, "Well, here is what I suggest you do for a 1 month period of time. Now, your husband is a great farmer, and he gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning. What I want you to do is get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, make him a sumptuous breakfast of steak and eggs and potatoes, and have a hot pot of coffee to take with him out to his tractor when he goes to work. And then set the alarm for 9:30 and go out into the fields and find him and bring him a homemade pie for his mid-morning snack and some fresh coffee. And then when he comes in for his noonday meal, make sure it's sumptuous of pork chops and everything that's good that you can think to make. And then have him take a nap in the afternoon before he goes back to the fields. And then at night, at the dinner that you make him for sumptuousness, make sure that he has his slippers and he has his pipe ready at the end of the meal so that you can sit him down in front of the television set and eliminate the stress in his life. And if you'll do that for a 30-day period, I think everything will be fine." They're on their way home in the pickup truck. Husband looks at wife and says, "What the hell did the doctor tell you?" She looks at him and says, "He said you're going to die." That's a good Al-Anon story. That's good. That's good. All right, I always get the opportunity, and I'm really glad that I was able to come over and share with you folks tonight. And if I've said anything at all that would help the newcomer, that was my goal. We like to have fun on the program Alcoholics Anonymous. If we didn't have laughter, I wouldn't have stayed, you know. And every time I get the opportunity to share at a speaker's meeting, I always close in the same way. And I will do that for you tonight. This they did, those of you, how many went to Seattle at the World Conference when it was held up there? Well, you heard this up there. I had memorized this in 1985. I'd heard it on a tape from a guy from Louisiana, and I just love the story. This, to me, is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called The Auctioneer. The auctioneer stood before the crowd, and he went to the table, and he picked up an old violin. It was all scarred and battered and covered with dust. And he held it up to the crowd and said, "What am I bid for the old violin?" "Who'll bid $1? $2, maybe $3. And from the crowd, $1 came, and then $2, and then $3. Going once, going twice. But before he could say sold, said he, from the back of the crowd came an old man shuffling through, all battered and scarred like the old violin. And he came up to the auctioneer, and he picked up the violin and its bow and began to tighten its strings. And he set the violin to his chin and began to play, and a melody came forth as the angels sing. And he handed the violin back to the auctioneer and shuffled off back into the crowd. And the auctioneer held the violin up and said, "Now what am I bid for the old violin?" And from the crowd, $1,000, then $2,000, then $3,000. "Sold," said he. And another voice from the crowd said, "What changed the value of the old violin?" And another voice said, "It was the touch of the hand of the master." And I submit to you that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, many a battered and scarred soul, suffering from the disease of alcoholism, has been made happy, joyous, and free, simply and solely by the touch of the hand of our Master. Thank you very much.